by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm replaying a program from 2008, November 2008. We went to the Financial Summit in up in Washington, D.C. And at George Mason University, I arranged two speakers, and one was Joan Vion. She really knew the international financial system well. And so we got her up as our second speaker, and she did a marvelous job, and that's what we're going to rebroadcast this evening. And a little story about this, Jim Ponick, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and myself, George Butler, we went up there on that financial crisis. This was right after the 2008 financial, crisis hit us. And, there was a big meeting up there, and I thought, well, we're right at George Mason there, University in Virginia. Why don't we, have Joan Vion and the second man that I don't remember, speak, you know. And so we had two speakers. One spoke about the Continental, which was the early monetary unit of the colonies. And then Joan Vion came up on the second, hour and spoke. And, anyway, we had trouble. Who was sponsoring us originally was the Economic Society of George Mason. And then they found out what we're going to speak about, the Continental and the Federal Reserve and all that. And boy, they didn't want any part of us when they found out what the subject was. But anyway, I told them, I said, you've obligated that room for us, we're auditorium, and we're coming, we got it scheduled and everything else. Well, when we got there, we started looking around, and the techie was there, and he helped me. We were doing a live stream, okay, onto the internet. And, it was early on. It probably, we'd been doing some live streams for about a year at that time. First one was 2007, Ron Paul from the Independence Mall in Philadelphia. That was our first live stream. But anyway, we were there in George Mason. And, I remember Joan Vion and our other speaker came back to me. I was in the back with all the equipment cameras. And she said, I don't see anyone here. There was not one person that showed up from the Economic Society. They boycotted our speech. The techie came in and helped me verify that the Ethernet that in the auditorium there was good. So I told Joan Vion and our other speaker, I said, look, nobody's here. Just get up there and start speaking, okay? And just pretend, that this is a full auditorium. I said, we're recording it, and we're also putting it out on live stream. And tonight on this will be our second hour. I'm going to put the second hour up on our audio on the Secret Truth radio program, but also I'm going to put up on our site thesecrettruth.com. I'm going to put up this video of her, and the video has some slides that are very important also. But this is one of the most important speeches that we ever broadcast and that we ever did. Now, it goes back to 2008, and much of what she said about this world system, this world financial system, is beginning to come together, and it's very, very scary what is going on. So take note of that. Otherwise, she ends up with the Federal Reserve being a really big problem, and it has been. Ron Paul, out of Lake Jackson, Texas, He started running. He was a representative in the House for a number of years. He decided to run for president in 2008, for that election year. But we were already behind him in 2007. All right. Like I said, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and myself were up on the Independence Mall with her youngest daughter. And so we went up there in 2007. Then this financial crisis hit. We had to cover that in Washington D.C. And I said, well, you know, George Mason is out there. Let's get a couple of speakers and go out there and speak. And finally, the Economic Society did sponsor us, and then they boycotted the speech. You know what I mean? But anyway, the Federal Reserve, for a listening audience, whether you're new to this or not, is a privately held corporation. It has no federal ties except in name. And so these money mongers, G. Edward Griffin wrote a really good book, Creature from Jekyll Island, is where they first got together, the New York bankers and some German and British bankers. They got together in the late 1900s, and finally were able to pass the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and take over our financial system. In other words, what they did was create the Federal Reserve, which gave them a monopoly of money, credit creation, I should say. The U.S. mints located in different key cities have always printed the actual dollar bills and coined the actual change that we have been dealing with on, you know, for small transactions. But the big loans and so forth, are actually created through a entry on a set of books, through one of the member banks of the Fed. And so that's the way money is, and that's what credit really is. And the Federal Reserve System authorizes these banks to create a certain amount over and above their reserves of credit on their books. And then the way that works is they're able to clear each other's credits through checks, written checks. See, without a check writing system, then wouldn't be able to clear each other's debits and credits, because he's going to, you know, transport a bunch of gold and silver around. So when they went to this kind of fractional banking system, is what it's called, and clearing those credits with checks, then they were home free. Now, one way to understand how this originated, in the 1500s in London, the goldsmiths were holding large quantities of gold for making their products, jewelry and so forth, in their vaults, in their strong rooms. And so other wealthy people that had large amounts of gold finally agreed with the goldsmiths to leave that money on storage there with the goldsmiths. The goldsmiths had 24-hour security on their strong room. And so it was a good, safe place for wealthy people in London and in England to leave the gold that they had on deposit there with the goldsmiths. Well, the goldsmiths would give them a receipt for their gold. So anytime that people wanted to go down and get their gold back, the physical gold, they would go down and give the goldsmiths that receipt, and the goldsmith would turn over that amount of gold to them. See? So, that worked out for a while until the goldsmiths started thinking and realizing actually that they had these receipts out, but not everybody came in and got the gold out. Of course, they would charge them storage fees and things like that, all at the same time. So the goldsmiths started issuing more receipts than they had gold. And thus was born the fractional banking system, because they would have a lot more receipts out than they had gold. So all those receipts, if they were ever called for at their goldsmiths, they could never, you know, return the gold that was backed up by that receipt. So the wealthy were taking this receipts that they were issued from the goldsmiths and using that like money, Because if I gave you a receipt from a certain goldsmith and to buy a piece of property, you could go down to that goldsmith and get that actual physical gold. You didn't have to, you know, just hold that paper, but you could hold it and then give that to someone else. So this is the way the goldsmiths, you could say, discovered that they could issue more receipts than they had gold. And that's basically the fractional banking system in this country today. Now, Ron Paul began to see that we needed to reform this financial system. And so he led a charge to end the Fed, and that didn't fizzled out. Then his second, initiative was one that said, let's audit the Fed. And I don't think that that's ever, you know, come to a conclusion, to a legitimate conclusion yet either. But anyway, Ron Paul is a good person. He's trying to do what's right for this country and for we the people. Rand finally got in there as a senator, and he is beginning to stand up and on some of his speeches and stand up for we the people. And that comes out of that Paul family. And so Ron Paul, you know, educated, reared Rand and his other brothers and so forth. I think he has two other brothers and a sister, yeah, I believe. But anyway, that's what came out of that, and it was it's what shows when Rand Paul stands up in the Senate, he speaks with some authority that's backed up by the teachings of his father, Ron Paul. So anyway, that's basically what Joan Bion was saying at this speech at George Mason, and it was historic in a way, because here we were in the auditorium. The local economic society boycotted us. We didn't have one person, not one person came to listen to her speech, which was invaluable. And she's just one of the most stand-up ladies we've ever had speak. And she's a fine person. And she finally passed away a few years ago. But anyway, this speech talks about this international system of banking. And so it gives you the listening audience out there and the viewing audience, which you can watch on the video that I'm going to put up this evening, will give you a really good idea of what's going on out here in this society, in this money, in this banking. And that's where, Davos comes up. These people are out there. These are the money people, the industrialists, the corporate stuff. And they are contriving a system now called the Great Reset. It's merely a system to overcome populism, which is springing up all over the world. And they fear this populist movement that Trump set into motion. And this is what they're all about right now, is to contrive and create a system of thought, brainwashing all those good little members that meet there. Of course, this year it's a virtual thing. And all these people have been taught at these universities in finance and so forth. They all think the same. But anyway, this is what's going on. And you'll hear my opening statement here in a second. But Joan Bion, thank you. And thank God bless Joan Bion. That's all I can say. Here we go now with Joan Bion.
Joan Bion. She represents the Women's International Media Group. She's attended well over 100 meetings throughout the world. A great deal of these were international groups. We'll have her coming up in just a second. Here she comes now.
Good afternoon. I'm Joan Bion. And I'd like to thank you for coming and thank you for having me. Richard, I am honored to follow you. Much of what you said, I wholeheartedly agree and concur. With regard to the G20 meeting today, it was not specifically my intent to be here. I would have liked to have covered that meeting in person. However, a call to the White House revealed that only pooled press would be allowed to cover the meeting. In other words, you had to be part of the insider press or the White House press to be invited. However, I am very happy to be here instead. Let me also say, for some of you who may or may not know, I have spent the last year battling metastatic breast cancer. I am doing very well. Speaking here has taken a great deal of effort. And if I did not think it was important, I would not be here. It is so important that I would take every ounce of strength to put together this presentation five times over if I needed to. So with that, let's take a look at some information that not only pigtails with Richard, but also other information that as we face the future, and the future appears to be one of tremendous and grave and great bondage for not only you and I, but for our children and our children's children, we're going to take a look at some other things that are also at stake in this time of great financial crises. I have entitled this presentation, Your World, Your Financial Future, from Bretton Woods 1 to Bretton Woods 2, from individual nation states to an integrated, interdependent world. There is no doubt that everything that is going on is extremely complex. Ben Bernanke, Federal Reserve Chairman, said this just a day or two ago. The crisis we face in the financial markets has many novel aspects, largely arising from the complexity and sophistication of today's financial institutions and instruments, and the remarkable degree of global financial integration. Look at that, global financial integration that allows financial shocks to be transmitted around the world at the speed of light. The 2008 credit crisis is historic, and as Richard mentioned, it builds on and may be exacerbated far greater than 1929 because many Americans did not have the debt they have today. There will be structural changes, as we saw in the 1930s and in 1944 with Bretton Woods 1. It was a structural change of the world, and we can say that the world will never be the same. Our standard of living may and is changing forever. We're going to do an overview. We're going to look at the world before Bretton Woods 1, what happened at Bretton Woods 1, the world since Bretton Woods 1, current environment and credit crises, the Treasury blueprint, and Bretton Woods 2, a system of global regulatory reform. So let's take a look at the world before Bretton Woods 1. Very simple. Every individual country was its own. There was no free trade. They operated as individual, independent nation states. That is the world before Bretton Woods 1. The state sort of looked like this. There were various barriers around every individual country, and they looked like this. The economic, the political, the trade, the legal and judicial, the military and intelligence, and then a series of international financial barriers that are now all in the process of coming down. So what happened at Bretton Woods 1? It was the culmination of 2.5 years of planning, they say, for post-war reconstruction. Both the U.S. and the U.K. treasuries were prominent. They wanted an exchange rate stability. Interestingly enough, that's been hard to come by since 1971. But the dollar was deemed the strongest currency in the world, and it was made a world reserve currency. The architects of Bretton Woods 1 were Harry Dexter White from the U.S. and John Maynard Keynes from Britain. Here are the two architects. What happened at Bretton Woods? It set up what was called the IBRD, now called the World Bank Group. It set up the International Monetary Fund. It proposed the World Trade Authority, which Congress denied. John Keynes even wanted a world currency called Bancor. That didn't go too far. And as I mentioned earlier, the dollar was designated a world reserve currency. What is the World Bank Group? What do they do? In 1944, they were going to help rebuild the world, and they were going to help with developing the world. And in the 1970s, Robert McNamara, who became the president of the World Bank, basically doubled the size of the bank He did much more than that, but we don't have time to discuss all the things that he did. What does the World Bank do today? The IBRD, that's the World Bank itself, they lend to countries. IDA promotes economic activity. IFC, the International Financial Corp, is really the Wall Street of the World Bank. They set up currency offerings, global bonds, and they have been responsible for establishing stock exchanges in many third world countries, including China and Russia and South Africa. Then there's MIGA, and they provide insurance to foreign investors. Lastly, the World Bank actively supports sustainable development. What does the International Monetary Fund do? It is to be, or at the time, the keeper of the rules and the main instrument of public international management. It was to lend to countries in need. In 1969, it created its own monetary system called the Special Drawing Right. In 1974, after Richard Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, it adopted guidelines to manage a floating exchange rate system. The Special Drawing Right, what is the Special Drawing Right? As I mentioned a moment ago, it was created in 1969 by the IMF to support Bretton Woods and foreign exchange. It is used by the IMF as a unit of exchange. It is comprised of a basket of currencies. Every 5 years, they reweight this basket of currency. In other five-year increments, it's been five currencies. This time, it's four currencies. The dollar comprises 44%, the euro 34%, the yen 11%, and the British pound sterling 11% as well. It was adopted, interestingly enough, the Special Drawing Right was adopted by the Bank for International Settlements in 2003, they say, as an accounting measure. The IMF Bank today works with the World Bank on a broad array of financial arrangements. It created the Monetary and Capital Markets Department in 2007. It has a Global Surveillance Department, in other words, how to reduce global imbalances. Actually, that's a joke because they've created the global imbalances, and if they reduce it, then they can't rape, rob, and pillage. It also has a country surveillance program. In other words, it looks at many of the risks facing member countries, and it has a financial system stability assessment program. So the IMF has become, it's been pretty busy, let's just put it like that. The dollar was named the reserve currency back in 1944. We know today, because of the drop in the value of the dollar and the increase in the euro recently, that many countries have decided that they didn't want to use the dollar and they switched to the euro. Now, interestingly enough, we have a reverse at this moment, whether or not it's a true reverse, and the dollar has been strengthening against the euro. But it was held in large quantities by many governments and institutions as part of their foreign exchange reserves. It was used as the pricing currency for oil and gold. That is in the process of changing. In 1971, August 15th, Richard Nixon ordered a 90-day wage and price freeze control. He asked for tax cuts, a new job plan, and he severed the link between the dollar and gold. In other words, what happened is, for the first time in history, the monetary system of the world was not based on a tangible like gold. What was it based on? Actually, fiat. Nothing. When he severed any tie between our currency, the dollar, and the gold standard, for the first time in history, the world traded purely on paper. And when you have paper, you have no accountability. So the dollar started to float against other major currencies, the Deutschmark and the yen. Since 1971, the dollar has dropped between 66 and 70% in value against the euro, the yen, the Deutschmark. Where is the world since Bretton Woods won? Well, you see all these barriers between the nation states. every time an international organization was set up, it tore down the barriers between nation states. So when the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were set up, it started to tear down the economic barriers between the nation states. In 1945, when the United Nations was set up, it tore down the political barriers. In 1994, when the World Trade Organization was set up, it tore down the trade barriers. In other words, a 27,000-page treaty passed by a lame duck Congress tore down all the trade barriers between countries. Interestingly, what it really did is, for the first time in history, farmers, businessmen, manufacturers compete globally, not just locally across the street or across town or across the state. In 1998, the legal barriers between the countries fell with the establishment of the International Criminal Court. This court is set up for the first time since Rome to try alleged criminals, international criminals, at a court in The Hague. In 2001, the military and the intelligence barriers fell as countries started to work together as part of the coalition of the willing looking for the faceless terrorist. And where are we now? There have been many parts and segments of the financial barriers that are in the process of coming down, and we're going to take a look at some of them at this point. What the biggest thing that is looking to come down and be torn down is the last barrier between the nation states, and that is a system of national financial regulatory rules. And what they want to do at Bretton Woods II is put all the countries in the world on the same page when it comes to global regulations. The current credit environment. Obviously, about the only thing we can say is we are in chaos. And what do we have here? In taking a look at all of the international organizations that have been set in place as the different barriers have come down, the international financial level was set up in 1944 with the IMF World Bank. The political level above the nation state was set up in 1945 with the establishment of the United Nations. The trade, international trade agreements were set up in 1994 with the establishment of the World Trade Organization. The legal in 1998 with the establishment of the International Criminal Court. The military and the intelligence in 2001, and where we are right now with Bretton Woods II, is a global regulatory system as a result of the global credit crises. And it's not in a solid line because it is what is coming into play. This is the global level above the nation state. Some have called this the New World Order, from George Bush Sr. to CNBC. We recognize, said John Snow at the G7 finance ministers meeting, that we are so interdependent that growth in Asia is as important to us as our growth is important to Japan, and Japan's growth is important to the European nations and so on. So that we are all interconnected in ways that one nation's growth feeds and assists in other parts of the globe. This was in 2001. George Bush, our current president, just said yesterday, we live in a world in which our economies are interconnected. Financial turmoil, any world, anywhere in the world, affects economies everywhere in the world. David Faber, yesterday on CNBC, said, is the New World Order around the corner as the G20 meets? We're about to find out. Where is the world since Bretton Woods won? Well, let's take a look. There are several pieces to the financial element. As was mentioned, the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. In 1930, the Bank for International Settlements was established. In 1971, as we saw, Richard Nixon severed gold from the dollar. In 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed and replaced by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which they now say and credit the 2008 credit crises as stemming from the repeal of the Glass-Steagall. Now, what do they say? Do we have to put the Glass-Steagall back up? Oh, no. The new answer is the Treasury blueprint for a modernized financial regulatory system. Let's take a look. Long before the barriers fell between the nations, powerful and evil men were planning to control the monetary system of the world. The concept of a central bank came from Sweden, which was the first to form a private company to lend to the government without a fixed time period for repayment. The central banks of the world first started in 1688 with the Swedish Bank, then in England, the Bank of England, in 1694. The Bank of England was formed when William Paterson, who was a businessman in the city of London, proposed raising 1.2 million British pounds to be lent to the government on the condition that its subscribers or stockholders were incorporated as a stock company. In other words, a private corporation would lend to the government of England. The central bank, that's what it is, would lend to the British government in perpetuity. That means forever. In other words, they would collect interest on the debt forever. I am very grateful to Edward Wessex, who is Prince Edward, the youngest son of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, in his series Crown and Country. I was so grateful for him verifying that his great-great-great-great, however many greats, grandfather, King William, was the largest investor in the Bank of England. Now, I think this is fabulous, because if you think that the British royal family has not invested in the bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, or the Bank of France, or the Bank of Italy, or the Bank of Japan, I think you would be misguided, because there are people, whether they are bankers or royalty, who always want to make money. The bank would be called the Bank for Perpetual Interest. In other words, using debt-based lending or usury, the bank would make its money on the loans to the government. Here is an actual document that talks about how his grandfather was the largest investor. You can see the sum of £10,000 right there. The Bank of England was not the last bank set up. We had the Bank of France in 1803, the Dutch Central Bank in 1814, the Bundesbank in Germany in 1870, the Bank of Japan in 1882, the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913, the Bank of Canada in 1934, the Comecon countries in the 1990s, and guess what? The last bank, surprise, surprise, the Bank of Iraq. What do you think happens to a country that doesn't have a central bank? It's one of the first things that happens. What happened to us? In 1913, the U.S. Senate passed the Federal Reserve Act to set up a private corporation to manage the monetary system of the United States. It's called the Federal Reserve Bank. It was passed at 11:45 p.m. on December 24th by a group of greedy senators, to say the least, after their colleagues who opposed the act recessed and went home for the Christmas holiday. It shifted the responsibility of America's finance from Congress to a private corporation. Here is a picture of the Federal Reserve Bank in Washington, D.C. And they issue their own currency. It says Federal Reserve Note. This is the currency of the Federal Reserve. It is not the currency of the United States of America. The Federal Reserve is not part of our government, and it has no reserves. So what does that mean? It prints paper money on demand to lend to the U.S. government in the form of treasury bills, notes, and bonds. Because it prints money instead of having money in their vaults, they use debt as the basis for lending. Can anything come out, can anything good come out of debt-based lending? No. The Federal Reserve Act, again, you can't say it enough, shifted the responsibility of the country's finances from Congress to a private corporation. The U.S. taxpayer is in debt to a private corporation. Now, why can't Americans forgive themselves interest on the debt? Because we don't owe it to we the people. We owe it to a private corporation. The Federal Reserve has had a number of empowerments. Since its inception, it's been amended over 195 times. And you can see that in 1999, there were changes made as it broadened the range of collateral that it would take, types of collateral that it would take at its discount window. In March of this year, it agreed to take mortgages as collateral, i.e. Fannie and Freddie, and who knows, they might take your mortgage next. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury have created a $30 billion line of credit for J.P. Morgan to buy Bear Stearns. This is the first time that this action had been taken since the Great Depression. It's worked with central banks on coordinated rate cuts. It has extended liquidity to other central banks just recently. With the credit crisis, the Federal Reserve powers are being greatly expanded. And I cannot say that enough. In September of 2008, the Federal Reserve took control, as I mentioned, of Fannie and Freddie. That was $5.4 trillion. With the proposed Treasury blueprint, the powers and the finances, if you will, of the Federal Reserve will be greatly enhanced. Before we talk about the blueprint, let's talk about the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. Carol Quigley, in his book Tragedy and Hope, said this of the Bank for International Settlements. It was to be the apex of financial capitalism. Quote, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which they themselves were private corporations. I've had the honor, the opportunity of covering about 8 or 9 annual meetings at the Bank for International Settlements. What does it look like? Very simple. They have a central bank or a private corporation in about 164 countries of the world. The central banks that comprise the Bank for International Settlements coordinate and work together. We can see basically a global central bank coming into force. Part of the Bank for International Settlements is the Financial Stability Forum. In 1999, it was set up as a result of the Asian credit crises. The Financial Stability Forum is comprised of the G7 central bank ministers. Now, the G7 is comprised of the United States, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, Great Britain, and Canada. And they did add Russia. The G7 Treasury secretaries, the G7 regulatory agencies like the Comptroller of the Currency and FDIC, and then as well you have a number of other agencies from the Bank for International Settlements, which is the Banking Committee on Banking Supervision, the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the International Organization of Security Commissions, and the IMF World Bank. I think you're going to see a lot from the global, from the Financial Stability Forum, which is the global regulator, in my opinion. The Bank for International Settlements works very closely, as I mentioned, with not only the world central banks, but the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. So you can see that above the nation state, and even above the UN level, which we discussed a moment ago, you have the financial level, comprised of insurance, the central banks, and the International Association of Security Commissions, which basically is a United Nations of the World Security and Exchange Commissions, or stock exchanges. And they work closely together. In a BIS working paper in January of 2006, because of global imbalances, they wrote that consideration should be given to going back to a more rule-based system, a gold standard, or establishing a single international currency. More realistically, they even talked about regional blocks of currency, such as the dollar, the euro, the renminbi. They said that the IMF should be accorded substantially more power to force both creditors and debtors to play their roles in the adjustment process. We have seen in the last year the rise of a global central bank, as there has been on numerous occasions coordination between the Federal Reserve in America, the European Central Bank in Europe, and the Bank of Japan in Asia. We have also seen, again, just in September, and I believe also October, a second infusion between other central banks of the world. Now, let's talk about the Treasury Blueprint. This is a very key document. It was written by Hank Paulson in March of this year. And what does it recommend? The blueprint is very adamant in recommending far changes in our whole entire system. First, they say that there should be a change in the federal banking charter. Currently, the federal banking charter puts commercial banks under their control, or auspices, maybe that's a nicer word. The blueprint recommends that bank holding companies, savings and loans, thrifts, and credit unions all be moved into a new banking charter along with the commercial banks. The Federal Reserve would then have authority and control over them. It also recommends that the insurance industry, which currently is under the auspices of individual states, and the state of Maryland, the state of Oklahoma, the state of Arizona, they all regulate life insurance, disability insurance, homeowners insurance, car insurance, you name it. And now they're saying in the blueprint that, and especially I think they probably wrote it back in March, knowing AIG would fail, hindsight, of course, that as a result of AIG failing, which operates in all 50 states, that it is time to federalize the whole entire insurance industry. They would set up an insurance commission, and the Federal Reserve would chair the insurance commission. They are saying, as a result of the mortgage industry and the subprime crises, that they need to create an oversight system for the mortgage industry. And they would create a mortgage origination commission. And guess what? The Federal Reserve would sit as chairman on the mortgage origination commission. Regarding the payment and settlement system, which Wall Street has responsibility over, now the payment and settlement system undergirds all of Wall Street's exchange between people who want to buy a security, whether it's a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, a treasury bill, a global bond. That's what the payment and settlement system is. Bottom line is the blueprint recommends that the Federal Reserve should be given responsibility for the payment and settlement system. Lastly, the blueprint says that the Federal Reserve should become market stability regulator, the regulator of last resort. And we can see, Justin, all of the action it has taken recently with the bridge loans and other loans opening up their the central bank for 24-hour global access, putting $70 billion, $180 billion, $225 billion, $74 billion, $900 billion, etc., for various things into the system to help calm the system, that the bottom line is when you take a look at how much they've put in, when you add it all up, I was wondering where that line went, you know, since March, they've injected in everything I showed you in the last two slides over $2 trillion. When you add the bailout, you have another $1 trillion for a total of $3 trillion. Now, where do they get this money? They print it. This is debt-based money. Who's responsible? You and me, we the people. So we can see that in the middle of all of the crises that we are facing, that there's another alternative. There is another agenda, and that is to switch to the Federal Reserve, the last vestiges of our economic sovereignty. This is what it looks like. We have currently under non-Federal Reserve authority, we have credit unions, insurance companies, mortgages, payment and settlement, and, well, they're not the market stability regulator, but we'll leave that there right now. And this is what they're saying should happen. The credit unions should be transferred over under Federal Reserve control. The insurance industry should be transferred over under Federal Reserve control. Mortgages should be transferred under Federal Reserve control. The payment and settlement system should be transferred to Federal Reserve control. And they should become the oversight or market stability regulator for Wall Street. Is this a coup d'etat or is this a coup d'etat? So what is going to happen at Bretton Woods 2? Let's first review a few things. One, Bretton Woods 1 started the international level of governance above the nation state. It set up the IMF World Bank. It made the dollar the reserve currency. It said it wanted exchange rate stability, which is impossible if you don't have anything backing your dollar. In 1971, as I said, Nixon took the dollar off the gold, and we now have a fiat currency. They all float. We have open markets and globalization, which is responsible for global imbalances. And now we have the subprime crisis that started in August of 2007 that has evolved into the credit crisis January of 2008, which has now evolved into a global credit crisis. How timely. All that in 1 year. Take a look at the world. We have a world in crisis, global imbalances, a lack of confidence, frozen credit markets. I've written extensively about some of these things. You can go to my website, womensgroup.org, womensgroup, womensgroup.org, and read my commentary on the right-hand side. And now we have a new change in Washington. This new change is not Obama. This new change is a complete change in the power structure of Washington, as stated in the Washington Post, September 18, 2008. That paper looks a little beat up. It is, because I couldn't believe what I was reading. What does it say? Lawmakers on both sides expressed concern yesterday that they have had no control over when and how federal money has been used to curb the panic on Wall Street. Congressional leaders learned of the AIG rescue late Tuesday evening during a hastily called meeting in the Capitol with Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who explained the deal after it was done. Shades of Federal Reserve 1913. Paulson and Bernanke have taken the lead not only from lawmakers, but from President Bush. Bush has left direct management of the crises to them and other advisors and has limited his public remarks on the economy. On Tuesday, he canceled plans to brief reporters after meeting with his economic advisors. What we have really seen is a complete shift in power. Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, Tim Geithner, president of the New York Federal Reserve, Paulson, Robert Steele is no longer at Treasury. So we have these three bandits. Is that what they say, sheriffs? We have these three new sheriffs who are really bandits in disguise. They now run the United States of America. Effectively forget Congress. Why? The Federal Reserve tells Congress what to do. So where are we now? There is one last barrier that separates America from all the other countries of the world. A global credit crisis is needed to remove the last barrier. What is this barrier? It's our national regulatory systems over the banking, the insurance, and the brokerage industry in America, besides the other areas. What is global interdependence? David Dupuy set up the World Economic Forum in 2003. One of the problems we have is that we have a global world and a global market, but are still governed by national rules and national leaders. You cannot solve problems without international solutions. America is in the process of changing. The SEC has open debate on adopting international accounting rules. That was in August. I happened to be at a meeting, I was covering a meeting in 1995, maybe 1996, the International Organization of Security Commissions. And I ended up interviewing a gentleman in Britain who started the move for international accounting rules. Paul Volcker, one of our former Federal Reserve chairmen, has been actively working to push global accounting rules. There was numerous articles, specifically in the Financial Times, think globally on financial regulation. Greenspan, amazing. Greenspan says he was wrong on regulation. Henry Waxman said to him on 1024, "You found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right? It was not working?" Greenspan, absolutely, precisely. You know, that's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I have been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well. As I recall correctly, the market went up that day, or it had a minimum loss. All right? Here we have a major admission, and it's glossed over. There have been articles from time to time, turn the Bank for International Settlements into a global central bank. Well, for all intents and purposes, it is. We now have the global summit today, and they is comprised of the G20. The G7 is in orange, and the other countries are in red. So you can see that the G20 is an extension of the G7, or the G8, including Russia. And they are meeting to make changes. What are some of the possible outcomes? I am not saying that these are outcomes today, but I am saying, based on what Bretton Woods 1 established, Bretton Woods 2 is supposed to, if you will, lock it all up. Yes, there will be a global regulatory agreement, or the beginning of it, because after all, a global crisis demands that every country of the world change their national rules for their banking, their finance, their mortgage industry, their insurance industry, to a global one. Deeper integration, yes. Rise of a global central bank, yes. Rise of the IMF as a key role for global oversight. Well, that's what they would like. Many people poo-poo the IMF, but they still keep getting money. The empowerment of a world bank, yes. A global currency, I'm not saying today, but soon. That's what we're going to have. What will Bretton Woods 2 do? We already saw this before. This is the authorities put in place the international level of government above the national levels of government, and now the global regulatory framework with accounting rules and the Financial Stability Forum. Yes. Global regulation is the final piece needed for a total integration globally of all the countries of the world. Total integration financially, politically, trade, legal, military and intelligence, and regulatory. Now, I might talk about this, but do I agree with this? No way. In 2005, the annual Bank for International Settlements said, citing global economic imbalances, they suggested working towards an international macro-financial stabilization framework. How do you like that? I was able to interview Paul Volcker on the left at a conference in 2004, and I asked him what he saw for the future, and he told me that they made a lot of mistakes. And I said, "Well, sir, what do you see for the future?" He said, oh, for the long term, but it's a long ways off. If we are going to be successful in a globalizing world, we should have an international currency. So I shot back and I said, like the special drawing right? Needless to say, there's no answer because he refused to answer. In order to solve the credit crises, Congress needs to take a different path than the one Treasury has put before them. We are a debtor nation. And as Richard pointed out, true freedom is being free from debt. Ask anyone who's losing their home. And who were the architects? Let's go back. Harry Dexter White from the U.S., John Maynard Keynes, the father of Keynesian economics. He said, and Roosevelt agreed, deficit spending is the way out to get us out of the depression. We went from the Great Depression in 1933. When you start taking a look at how much debt we had, it was 287%. It dropped till 84. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. And now we're back up to record levels. The Great American Debt Bubble, this is from Bad Money by Kevin Phillips. This is for the year 2006. And we can see that the debt of America has gone up exponentially. The total debt is $44 trillion. It has risen 18.5% a year over the last 34 years from 1974. Let's put it in perspective. From 2001 to 2007, we've had a major debt explosion. Outstanding foreign debt has gone up 104%. I mean, it's doubled. Outstanding home mortgage debt has doubled. Outstanding domestic financial debt is up 71%. Annual U.S. current account deficit has basically doubled. Do we understand why we're having trouble? The Federal Reserve prints money out of thin air. It charges the federal government interest on newly created money. It's in the process of transferring key components of our financial sector to their control. And that includes, as I mentioned, the credit unions, the state chartered banks, the insurance industry, the mortgage industry, payment and settlement system, and total control. Why can't we, the people, forgive ourselves the interest on the debt? Again, I cannot say it enough. We owe it to a private corporation. Senator Benton of Missouri said this about the Federal Reserve. The government itself ceases to be independent and safe when the national currency is at the will of a company. That's the Federal Reserve. All property is at their mercy. The price of real estate, of every growing crop, of every staple article is at their command. Stocks are their playthings. Americans are in bondage to the Federal Reserve. The world is in bondage to central banks. In conclusion, any recommendations by our Congress that does not include closing the Federal Reserve and eliminating the interest we owe perpetuates financial bondage for every American with no way out. Congress will not vote to close the Fed, then we must do what the children of Israel did when in bondage to the Egyptians. Cry out to God.